Hello, everyone, and welcome to this audio conference training for rural grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. My name is Liz Carlson, and I'll be your host for today's call. The topic for today's session is part of a two-part series. The series is What's in a Word? How Definitions of Violence Against Women and Children Shape Our Interventions. Today's discussion is going to focus specifically on the five types of domestic violence. I'm joined on the line by the director at Praxis, Ellen Pence, who will be the trainer for today's call. Ellen, you're there, right?
Yes.
Hello, welcome.
Hi, Liz. How are you?
Very well. So before I turn the call over to Ellen, I'm just going to go over a couple of details about how these sessions work. First of all, we hope you've been able to access the binder of materials that's intended to supplement the training today. There's a PowerPoint with a lot of really good information that we would like to encourage you to go to our website to download and to follow along with today if you have that opportunity. In the bio, you will see, in addition to the PowerPoint, in the binder, there's also a bio for Ellen, and she will introduce herself a little further, too, once she gets started. We'd also like to let you know that we record these sessions, and we are now able to make them available online for listening to and streaming. So if you go to our website, you'll be able to navigate through there to past events, recordings, and listen to this once it's posted. Also, the operator on the line today is Megan, and she will have all of the phone lines muted throughout the training today, and periodically she'll be taking questions and comments from you all. So she will give you the directions about how to get into the question queue. That should happen in about 20 or 25 minutes. So with that, I'm going to ask Ellen to go ahead and get us started. So Ellen, I guess we're ready for you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Liz. I think one of the things, too, we're supposed to be saying is that the views that I express today are not necessarily the views of the Office Against Violence Against Women, even though they are paying me to say these things. They have a lot of people out there that are providing training for grantees, and particularly rural grantees, and so they want you to be exposed to a lot of ideas. It doesn't necessarily mean they agree with all the ideas you're exposed to, so that's a little disclaimer from the beginning. I want to talk today about this whole term domestic violence and break it down as to what we mean by it. And tomorrow I'm hoping people are going to get onto both parts because I'm going to do a lot of stuff about definitions and what this means about people who are battering and people who are being battered, et cetera, et cetera. And then tomorrow I'm going to focus a lot more on the issue of children and the issue of intervention. So but right now I just wanted to start out with talking about this whole term of domestic violence and how it came about. For many, many years, this whole issue of wife beating or the abuse of women in marriages was always called battering. And that started in the early 1970s when the term came out of England, and it came out of this book that a woman wrote about battered wives in the very early 1970s, and this whole issue just kind of came to the public's attention. And people talked about what was happening to wives is that they were being battered. And then started this whole social movement coming out of the women's movement to respond to battering, and they called themselves the Battered Women's Movement. And so this term battering was referring to the relationship that happens, or the thing that happens when a partner, typically a male partner, establishes a relationship of control or dominance over a woman partner through battering her. It was not a term that really wanted to explain all violence that happened between intimate partners. And so when the system started to respond to this issue as it was coming to the fore and legislators started to meet, et cetera, this new term got introduced called domestic violence. And domestic violence is oftentimes referring to any violence that occurs between intimate partners. So any person who in any way uses violence against their intimate partners, that's domestic violence. Sometimes domestic violence means any violence that occurs within a household, people who have cohabited, meaning if a child other hits their child, that would be domestic violence. But most people tend to limit the use of the term in the professions of domestic violence to violence that occurs between adult intimate partners. Now, when you look in your laws, like, for example, in Minnesota, where I'm from, the law is much broader than just adult intimate partners. It's anyone who's living in a household together. And oftentimes it's referring to, in some states, violence that occurs between adults. So this term domestic violence means different things, whether you're using it legally in your state or whether you're using it within your profession. But let's just say for the purposes of our discussion now that domestic violence means violence that occurs between intimate partners. Now, there's a big problem with this term that's come about, and one of them is that it lumps all violence that occurs in intimate relationships together and treats it as one thing. So if you're a police department and you have a policy that says, in domestic violence cases, we're going to do X, Y, or Z, does that really mean in domestic violence cases? In other words, if I get mad at my husband and I throw a bag of potato chips at him and I say, you know what, you are useless around the house today, and I throw my bag of potato chips at him, that's domestic violence. Do we really want the police to respond to that the same way we want to respond to him that I took a chair and hit him over the head because he didn't mow the lawn? Those are two different domestic violences. And when we lump all domestic violence together as one thing, we tend to do what I'm calling McDonaldizing our whole system's response. So in the last 5 or 6 years, people have tried to tease out all that violence and come up with kind of, when we use domestic violence, kind of categorize it in ways that's more useful for people. So we're not lumping together really different things and treating it as one thing. The other problem with it is that most legal solutions or even human service solutions that we've come up with for battering have gotten lumped together as domestic violence. So a lot of the fighting that you see between therapists and domestic violence advocates and other people about what is this all about, and aren't women just as violent as men, part of the reason that all that fighting goes on is because we are lumping all violence that occurs within intimate relationships and calling it one thing. So if we're talking about battering, that is when one partner establishes control and dominance over another through the use of intimidation, coercion, and violence. That's what battering is. If we don't mean that, and we really mean any old slap or hit or push or shove, then we've got, that's where we have kind of the fighting that's going on, the disagreements, the accusations that people are theoretically off balance, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a big problem with using this term domestic violence, and I want to encourage people to really break that term down in your own program and in your planning and thinking and theorizing and also coming up with interventions that you think are appropriate. And I want to give you five ways of breaking that down today, and you can decide if you want to go with another one. I'll also give you some references to other people who break it down a little bit differently. But let's take the first form of domestic violence and call it battering. And battering is when a person establishes control or dominance over another person through the use of intimidation, coercion, and violence, and other abusive acts. And I think many of you might be familiar with the power and control bill. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. And battering is really using those tactics against an intimate partner. I think that most people would agree that any group of people, like whenever you have a violence like, by, for example, white people against people of color, or gender-based violence of men against women in marriage, or any of these kinds of group, one group is violent against another historically in society, then you always have violence by the group who's being violated and being held down. They use violence back up towards their, if we want to use a political term, towards their oppressor. And so violence is never a one-way street. It's not like somebody just beats the heck out of, a group beats the heck out of another group and they never fight back. Most groups fight back. Most groups use some kind of force or violence or forms of resistance back at whoever is keeping them down. And within in personal relationships, most people who get battered use some kind of resistance. And very few people completely submit to it without any kind of force or any kind of acts of resistance back at the abuser. And so we call that violence coming back at the abuser resistive violence or coping violence. And the reason that I'm going to distinguish between some of it is resisting and some of it is just coping with it, and you'll see the difference when I give the examples later. Next, you have battering that occurs, I don't know, there's probably 60 different groups or 65 different groups on this phone call, and there's an average of maybe 3 people in a room. So there's 180 people that are listening into this phone call right now. And of the 180 people listening to the phone call, 180 are also probably adults. And of that 180 adults, 90 of you statistically have hit, kicked, pushed, punched, bit, pulled your partner's hair, done something physically against your partner. And probably a fairly small percent of that violence is battering. There's a lot of physical violence that happens in relationships in this country. There are in most countries, but in this country, I'm just going to stick with this country right now, a lot of people hit or punch or scratch a partner at one time or another. That kind of violence that is common amongst couples is referred to by Michael Johnson, who's someone who writes about these kind of divisions a lot, as common couples violence. I never use that term because I never know if he's saying the violence is common or the couples are common. But I call it a non-battering couples violence. In other words, it's battering that occurs within an intimate relationship, but it's not violence, but it's not battering. Now, that violence doesn't have connected to it an attempt to dominate the person. The kind of violence that is you'll see this very frequently in couples where one person has an affair. And the other person, every time she thinks that he's out with that other woman or every time something comes up about that other woman in her mind or in reality, she goes off on him and she kicks him out of the house. She screams at him. She starts saying, how could you have done this to us? And that fight leads to her hitting him or pulling his hair or just wanting to get back at him for what he's done. The other kind of violence that is let's say a woman who's an alcoholic. And every time he comes home and she's drinking, he'll grab her bottle of vodka and start pouring it down the sink, and she'll go and grab him and start hitting him and kicking him and trying to get him to quit pouring her bottle down the sink. He might backhand her as he's trying to pour that bottle down the sink. It doesn't make him a batterer. It doesn't make her a batterer for going after him when he's doing it. That kind of violence, which doesn't have associated with it a patterned use of intimidation, coercion, and violence to dominate and to control the other, is what we call common couples or non-battering couples violence. The other kind of violence that it occurs frequently that gets lumped as part of domestic violence is what you'd say is violence that's associated with some kind of pathology. And that violence includes violence that is associated with mental illness, violence that's associated with some kind of perhaps brain trauma that a person has experienced, violence that's associated with a lot of, you know, like some drug use and some alcohol. Now, this is a very tricky thing to say, and it's like a sin with some people in the Bad as Women Wound to ever suggest that alcohol, the abuse of alcohol, causes some people to be violent in their intimate relationships. The abuse of drugs takes a person who previously was not violent and was not establishing a relationship of dominance and makes it so that when they're on those drugs, that meth or that cocaine, that they become agitated, become aggressive, and they hit people, including their partners. It's domestic violence. It's not necessarily battering. And the solution to it is to stop the use of the drugs or the alcohol. And when you stop the use of the drugs or the alcohol, the violence also ends. Now, there's a couple things about that is so irritating to people is that we have spent years and years trying to convince people that battering is not caused by alcoholism, and it's not. Battering is not caused by alcoholism. Sometimes it makes it worse. In a very few cases, drunk people batter less when they're drunk. That's fairly rare, but that happens occasionally. But battering is not caused by alcoholism. And sobering up a batterer will not make them stop using violence. So this is a couple things that I think people need to distinguish here, is that when you have a small percentage of alcoholics using violence as part of their alcoholism or their drug abuse, generally, and including against family members, you have to kind of come to the conclusion that sobering them up will stop that violence. So I want to distinguish between the alcoholic batterer and the alcoholic whose only violence is connected with the use of alcohol and drugs. And so that kind of pathological violence is something that is, I don't want to say it's rare, but it's not what you typically see when people are calling the police and trying to get an intervention, going to shelters and seeking help from human service providers and saying, I'm afraid of him, da-da-da-da. It might be the kind of people that end up in drug abuse programs, that end up in marriage counseling, but it's not typically the kind of people that seek help from domestic violence-related programs, from police, or even oftentimes from hospitals. The last form of violence that I'm going to say but not talk much about is a form of violence called enemy. And enemy is the sociological term for when you have a total breakdown in social norms. So what you find in, for example, after Katrina, remember all these people ended up in these great big stadiums, and there was a lot of rape of women, a lot of violence that went on in those. When you have just kind of a breakdown, there's no police around, there's nobody policing anybody, you just have a breakdown of social norms. This happens in the time of war. It happens in a lot of camps when you've got millions of displaced people that are living in camps and situations where there's just a breakdown in society. Then you have a huge upswing in violence, and that upswing in violence is often targeted against the vulnerable, again, women and children. A lot of increased rape, a lot of increased battering, a lot of increased violence towards children. And that kind of violence is stuff that we're, as the kind of programs that we're involved in, we're not dealing with that so much. You can make an argument that in some communities in our society, within this country, that there has been a breakdown of social norms that way. For example, in different periods of history, the whole colonization of Native nations, and not all Native nations to the same extent, but where people were taken away from their homes and put in boarding school, a lot of sexual abuse and physical abuse against people, lost their languages, lost the whole economic basis of their society. This created a lot of breakdown of social norm. And for many Native communities and tribes, the whole effort in the last 30 or 40 or 50 years has been to try to reclaim social norms and traditional values that just broke down during that whole process of colonization and that very violent process of forced assimilation that never worked the way that the assimilators wanted it to. And secondly, it was just a brutal, brutal forcing of people to lose all of those things that create social norms. And there was a huge breakdown in some of those groups, causing a lot of violence against women that you can't just attribute to the same things you would call. Then when I talk later about battering, you couldn't just always say that the kind of violence that then went on so extensively towards Native women was simply this notion of battering based on gender-based kind of power relationships. It was much deeper than that. So those are the types of violence, battering, resistive and coping violence, non-battering couples violence, pathological violence, and enemy. That last one, because no one has ever heard the term, and I'm probably not even pronouncing it right, we'll never get anywhere in the movement, but it's something that I think that we should acknowledge that goes on. Now, there's a problem when I break these forms of domestic violence down, and then everybody goes back and says, oh, there's different kinds of domestic violence, so we have to kind of assess for which kind of domestic violence is going on. And the first problem is that all the batterers are going to claim they're in group 3 and 4. You know, this is situational, Your Honor. I had a bad situation. She was talking. I didn't want to hear it. Something like that, you know. But it's going to be this whole notion of I'm not really battering. I'm not a batter. I'm the number 3. Or I'm a number 4. You know, that I was drinking. Now I've sobered up. And so the problem is over with. And so a lot of people don't like it when we start to break down like this, because they say we're going to go backwards. We're going to go back to the 70s when everything got blamed on alcohol. And then everyone's going to come in and claim to be a, a situational violence person. And we've spent so many years trying to get the courts away from that kind of thinking. But I want to talk about why I think we should do it anyway, even though there's these concerns that people have. I also think that this whole idea of talking about pathological violence plays in to a huge group of people that wants to say this is all about pathology, that there isn't a gender problem in our society, that this isn't about gender relationships, and that that kind of analysis is really old thinking, and that we really have to see this as pathological. And so all of these cautions that people have, I think, are real. I think that when you start introducing this into a community or to a CCR or to a visitation center interagency response, you're going to get a lot of misapplication of these ideas. That doesn't necessarily mean that we should abandon the project of trying to make these distinctions, because it can help victims. It can do a lot to help protecting, because it forces us to ask who is doing what to whom and with what impact. It forces us to start to say, well, what's really going on here? Because quite frankly, what is going on right now is people are treating all acts of domestic violence as one thing, and battering is getting watered down. What it means to be battered and to live with someone who's using that kind of intimidation and force against you is getting watered down with people who are getting hit once or twice in a relationship because they had an affair. It's all getting muddled up as one thing when it isn't really. And so I want to turn people's attention to the power and control wheel for a couple of minutes. And I don't, what slide is that on, Liz, the power
and control wheel? It's number 10.
Number 10, okay, because I'm not using the, I don't have the slide show in front of me.
Yep, it should be on the top of the fourth page.
Okay, so if for those of you who do have your PowerPoint presentation there, if you turn to slide 10, page 4, that power and control wheel, whenever I see people getting it out and talking about it or using it, I always want to go, wait a minute, let me explain to you how this thing came about and what it is and what it isn't. Because the first thing that the power and control wheel isn't is it's not a theory about battering or domestic violence. It is simply a description that was made by several groups of battered women over 7 or 8 or 9 meetings, where the groups of battered women, all living in one community, and so most of the women in these groups were working class or poor white women and Native women. That's who were in the groups that came up with this. And they were asked the question, what goes on when you live with a batterer? What is it that you're living with? And the reason we were asking that question of women was we were trying to come up with a curriculum of what to do with men who are being arrested and put into groups. And we're trying to say, what do you want us to talk to them about? What should we be addressing in terms of their behavior? And women started to say, well, you got to tell, abuse isn't just getting hit. It's more than that. It's the intimidation. It's the emotional abuse. It's the way they use the kids. It's the way they say, I'm the man of the house, king of the castle. It's the way they deny that they're doing it, that they hit you 1 minute and then turn around and say, look what you made me do. So women started telling these stories. And there were many more tactics of control that women talked about, but these were ones that every woman in the group experienced on some level. If she had kids, these tactics on that power and control wheel were all things that all of the women in the group were raising their hand saying, yes, I have a story to tell about this. And then those women started telling these stories. And if almost everybody in the room had an experience with either intimidation or emotional abuse, then we used it as a core tactic of batterers. And so we started to reframe the notion of batterers hitting out of sense of jealousy or aggression or anger to the violence being tactical, it being strategic, it being intentional. And that's the thing that women were reacting to, was this notion that men were out of control. And this woman at one of the groups just kind of laughed at it. He's not out of control, he's got all the control. And so then the next thing you know, we started talking about this idea of jealousy and anger and these things. And they were all there. The jealousy was there, the anger was there, the insecurity was there with the men. But in fact, what was more common to everyone was the sense of, I should be in control of you. And these were the tactics that they used to do it. Now, I think in a very important, I would say if there's two huge things that people in the system do wrong when they respond to these cases, in terms of understanding what battering really is they first they mix up stuff like battering and couples violence and pathological violence. They mix them up all as one thing, and they treat them all somewhere in the middle. And battering should always be treated as battering, and resistive violence should always be treated as resistive violence. It's inconceivable to me that we are 30 years into this social movement, and we cannot tell the difference between when someone is at the top of that triangle using violence down at someone, and when someone is down on the ground, laying on their back, kicking back up, and we do not know the difference between those two types of violence. And I know why we don't. There's a lot of reasons why that this is kind of hidden from us. And I'll talk about that a little bit later, the ways that all of this gets muddled up through the way that research is done and the ways that different kind of interest group try to portray this as being relationship and dysfunctional kind of things, but not about gender. But the gendered nature of this violence is frequently masked behind this idea that all of this violence is just a great big hodgepodge of stuff that happens in relationships, when in fact battering is historically embedded in the idea that one group of people has had a privileged position in marriage over another group. And that group is men over women. It's a gendered-based crime. And it's not to say that women never batter men, but it's rare. Women use a lot of violence against men, but it's rare for heterosexual women to batter men. And this is getting more and more obscured. When I first started doing this work in the 1970s, when we first started talking about all this stuff, everybody said, yeah, you're right, you know. My grandmother was battered by my grandpa. My mother was hit. And so most people just acknowledged that some people married brutal men, men that thought they could hit women whenever they wanted, men that controlled women. That was very, very easy in some ways for people to accept. And as time has gone on, there's been more resistance to that idea and more masking and obscuring and smoke screens put up, so that now we're having to say, well, women are just as violent as men, and we can't see this as gendered at all. So I want to say a couple of things about battering that I think are really crucial to understand. And once people in the system understand what a batterer is doing and the tactics that they're using, their protective the way they go about protecting the victim shifts and changes and becomes more effective. And so one of the big mistakes is that people will look at something like the power and control, and every one of you on the phone can look at that power and control wheel, and you can see things that you've done. Almost everyone on this phone call has put down a partner at one time or another. Almost everyone has lied to your partner. Almost every one of you have somebody you can't stand that your partner likes, and you do little things to kind of undermine that relationship. Most of you have used money in some way against your partner, maybe used the children against your partner. So when you look at that power and control and you say, well, I've done some of those things, and then you see women in relationships that are being battered who do those things, but they do them really harshly, like they won't let him see the kids. Or they not only call him names, but they're just bam blasting him. Then you start to say, oh my God, well, he does with his fist what she does with her mouth. You know, if she's being abusive and he's being abusive, his is just a little bit more violent. And he's stronger than her, so he can dominate her physically more, but look what she's doing too. This is the biggest problem that you see out there in the system, is the inability of people to see that when a person is battering another person, it is not the same thing as what you all do in your relationships, unless you're battering. But most of you who are doing some of these things in your relationship, who you're being mean or you're being abusive or you're not being nice sometimes, that's not the same as attaching those same behaviors to someone who puts a person in physical and sexual fear of their safety, in the fear of losing their children. And once you get to that place where you are afraid to talk, to say things, to think certain ways, to do certain things, because to do so means that you are going to be physically or sexually attacked, or that you're going to possibly lose your children, lose your home, etc. To be put in that kind of a state of constant anxiety and fear, and then to be called a whore or a slut, or to be told that you're lazy or stupid or no good, that those insults of you're stupid, lazy, no good, binds to that violence in a way that makes it a very different tactic of abuse than when some of you on this phone tell their partner, you are worthless, and walk out of a room. It's not the same thing. It's not the same thing when that person who is being controlled talks back to him and says, I hate you, I hate you, I hate your father, I hate who you are, you're no good, you're a bastard, you're this, you're that, all those kind of spewing back at him, hostility, dislike, insults, is not the same as what's coming down on her, because it doesn't have with it the ability to control how they're thinking, their cognitive processes, their physical safety, their sexual safety. We have this notion that there's four basic elements to what the attack is about. And it's about controlling the physical body, the emotional sense of self, the intellectual cognitive processes of the person, and then what you might think of almost as their spiritual kind of sense, is who they are in the world and what their purpose in the world is. So many of us have, you know, we have a set of emotions. We're able to be happy, we're sad, we're this or that. But there's another part of us that you almost think of like, I'm Catholic, and from the Catholic perspective, it's almost like our soul. It's almost like, what is my ontological reason for being on earth? And that's a bigger thing. It's my connection to how I see either a higher power or a bigger sense of being, et cetera, et cetera. And so that whole other part of us, our spiritual self, is also under attack by an abuser. And those things are not like something he's thinking, now I'm going to go after her spiritual self, now I'm going to go after her emotional self. It's a system of tactics and behaviors that knows how to keep her down and to keep her from pushing back up and resisting very effectively. And so when you equate that battering to the resistance, or that battering to some kind of common couples violence, or that battering to somebody who's a drunk and once in a while hits somebody, you end up with a system that isn't very protective of anybody, regardless of what kind of violence is going on, because it doesn't see what is. Once you see what's happening and what the violence is about, you adjust your intervention to that. So I have to see, if I go in on a domestic and this woman is all beat up, and then I grab him and I put my handcuffs on him, and then she goes up and spits at him and kicks him. Now I arrest her and him. Once those two end up in the courtroom together, if they get treated as the same thing, he assaulted her, she assaulted him, same probation for both of them, 52 weeks of a batterer's group, whatever it is that we're going to do and treat them as the same thing, we have now made him much more powerful in that relationship. We've used a lot of state resources, and we've missed the point of who is doing what to whom with what impact. Now, I don't want to say that we shouldn't respond to women's use of violence, that it shouldn't be, I'm not even saying that it shouldn't be criminalized, but how we respond to that in relationship to the violence that's being used against her are two very different things. So let me just take a moment here and see if, first of all, I just ask, there's two people on the line, Beth McNamara and Maren Hansen, who are both on the line trying to keep me on track here and make sure I'm actually talking about the things that we agreed I'd talk about. And Maren and Beth, do either one of you have any questions about how far I've gone so far?
Well, I think you're doing just fine with being on track. You're doing good. So I just want to explore with you a little bit. So this last piece, when we see police determining dominant aggressor and getting it wrong, or when we see battered women being arrested or being ordered into batterer's intervention, or when we see court orders identifying supervised visitation due to high conflict, and we begin to kind of explore this area of resistive violence or battering. Now, how should we suggest that workers or interveners, like supervised visitation workers or the police or the court or GALs, start to work to correctly identify what's going on?
Well, I'll talk a lot about that tomorrow, but the first problem with when people intervene, they usually intervene in some little tiny aspect, like the police officer is going out that night, and they're getting called out to a call of a specific event. Now, this event that happened in the context of a great, big, huge relationship. And I've been a lot of ride-alongs, and police will always start out, and they'll say, you want to tell me what happened tonight? They add that tonight. And then lots of times women will start back in, 1962 when they first married him or they first met him or something. And the people will say, excuse me, ma'am, could we just start with what happened tonight? Because the police are out there to find out, did someone tonight commit a crime? And if they did, what crime did they commit? And can I collect evidence to give to a prosecutor to decide if they're going to charge that crime and do something? So the function of the police officer is not to make an assessment of, is this battering or situational violence or this or that? But because we're so fragmented in how we do things, that police officer who actually could find out information about that doesn't see that as their job or their function, and they're just there to investigate this event. They investigate it, the document goes on to the prosecutor. The prosecutor sees his or her role is to prosecute the event, not the relationship. And so whenever we're trying to push for institutional reform, one of the things we're trying to do is we're trying to get people to not just relate to their function in the system, but to relate to what it is that actually goes on in people's lives. And when you can relate to this bigger picture of what's actually happening and use the police and use prosecution in a way that deals with battering, which means then you have to have a notion of who's doing what to whom, or resistive violence, all of a sudden those things become relevant because we don't want them just to prosecute that event, but we want them to stop the ongoing abuse. And once we see it as a patterned, ongoing, these people are going to come back in, let's look at the whole picture, not the event just of that night. Then you get people on a track saying, all right, that means we need to know more. Same with visitation centers. If they have this notion, this very narrow notion that I'm here to keep these kids safe for 2 hours a week, and they're not here to figure out that for the next 20 years, these two people, like it or not, are going to still be the parents of those four kids. And when they go away from your visitation center 6 weeks or 9 weeks or 15 weeks or a year later, those two are still going to be the parents of those kids, and whatever's going on with them, if you didn't deal with it while they were in your visitation center, nobody else is going to deal with it. So we need to get everybody in the system to see that when we're dealing with battering, we're dealing with a long-term pattern, not only a pattern of violence, but we're dealing with a relationship of dominance that the state, by how it intervenes, and the community, by how it intervenes, can actually change the power relationship between that man and woman, and in doing so, they can reduce the amount of violence that's going on, but not if they just look at it from their particular function in the system. I don't know if that answers your question, Beth, but I have a lot of hand motions going on here, so it answered something.
It was good.
Okay. Go ahead, Beth.
I was just going to ask if anybody else has questions.
Yeah. Megan, let's open up the lines and see if right now if anyone has questions about I've kind of given a beginning definition of these five forms of violence, and if anyone has any questions.
Okay. At this time, if you have a question or a comment, please press the number 1 once on your touchtone phone. All questions will be answered in the order that they are received.
I am going to go into a lot more detail about especially the first two, but I'm just wondering if anyone has a question about the five and if you want to add one.
There actually is one question from Joyce in West Virginia. Joyce, your line is now open.
Hi. Yeah, I'm not sure that my question is about the five definitions, but it's in your response about how the systems should look at the definitions of domestic violence. And we have issues with, although some systems may understand the broader definition, they say, but the law states that I am to look at this specific event, and so I have to do what the law states. And so we get that argument back. You understand the dynamics. I only look at the specifics because that's what I'm charged to do by law. How do you respond to that?
You're right. I think we made a lot of legal changes before we were ready to in some ways. You know, I remember when they first started making arrest mandatory, oh, my gosh, you know, we just weren't really ready for it. And all of a sudden they made any domestic assault was the police had to arrest on it. And so you started getting these, you know, the grandma got arrested, the guy got arrested, the woman, I mean, everybody was getting pulled in, and it was just way, way too much. And because we weren't sophisticated enough in our understanding to start to tease out, when do you really want a police to arrest? We don't want police, I don't think we want police to arrest every time someone does an act of violence against an intimate partner. I think that's too much. I think it doesn't lead to the kind of justice that we're looking for, and it doesn't lead to safety necessarily. So when people say the law doesn't allow it, I would always say, then let's think about how the law could be shaped differently to do what we want it to do. It's very hard to go back and change laws that you've always put into place and argue that this will make everyone safe. Well, now, I'll give you a good example is the gun law. I don't know that some people won't agree with me on this, but I always wish that we hadn't gone for that big federal gun law that says that anyone who has a protection order or who's been charged with domestic violence or, you know, convicted has to have their guns taken away, because it created such a backlash to it, like I worked for many, many years in Duluth, and everybody in Duluth goes hunting. We all have guns. You know, I had a gun. Everybody had a gun. You had a gun just to have a gun. I guess you just have guns. You got animals around your house. You got animals in your house. So people all have guns. And so the fact that someone hit someone doesn't necessarily mean that they can never have a gun again. But we did this law that seemed like we got to take guns away from batterers. But we ended up taking guns away from not only batterers, but people who were battering at very, very low levels. And that made every single misdemeanor conviction something you had to fight, and every conviction that judges didn't really want to make against a guy. So in communities like where I'm from, Montana, Wyoming, all those places, you ended up having judges feeling sorry for this guy because he's going to lose his gun if this conviction happens. And then you had prosecutors feeling sorry for him, and now everybody's trying to say, well, let's do a disorderly conduct on this. So I think that when we have laws that end up not doing what we want them to do, then the question is, how hard is it going to be to change it? I think to change that federal gun law is going to be very, very difficult. When Paul Wellstone was still alive, we talked to him about it several times, and he started putting out feelers about changing it and got absolutely bam-blasted by the anti-gun lobby, you know, which he actually is, he wasn't a gun person, sort of, so to speak. So politically speaking, it might be hard to change some of these laws, but that's still what we should be doing. So, for example, with police, we should be giving police discretion at some level on domestic assault cases. We should, you know, we use things like the predominant aggressor, but we also shouldn't be mandating arrest whenever you have probable cause. It's just too low of a standard. I think that we shouldn't be, this is where I want to say that what I think and what OVW thinks are probably two very different things, so that I'm not expressing the opinions of OVW here. I'm expressing my personal opinions at this point. But so the other thing is that when prosecutors prosecute, we have something like prosecutors should never plea bargain, or prosecutors shouldn't dismiss cases, or they shouldn't defer cases. Well, when we first started up this business, they deferred absolutely every domestic that was on a misdemeanor level. It was just automatic. And so we tried to get policies and procedures and things that would really reduce the deferral process. I think they should be deferring cases against people who are being battered that do minor acts of violence back at their batterer. I think those cases should be deferred. Those people should be put in some kind of an educational group. It shouldn't be 26 or 30 or 52 weeks long. They should be given support to deal with the batterer without using violence. They should be confronted on their use of violence as a mechanism that's not going to help them and get them in more trouble. But they shouldn't be convicted on the same level that a batterer is. And so I think a deferral in those cases would be appropriate. But to do that, you would have to, in some cases, just as you're saying, people say, I don't really have the authority to do that. We need to give them the authority. I actually think that to get funding from OVW, you can't have a deferral program. And so that might be one place that you start is saying, well, OVW, do you think maybe we shouldn't have that strict kind of line? I'm not exactly sure if this is even accurate what I'm saying, but I seem to recall that there's a policy that you can't get OVW funding if you're doing deferral programs. And on the other hand, I think you should do deferral programs in these acts of violence that are resistive, coping violence, because you give the batterer too much power when you convict a person for hitting him back. You give him way too much power when all of a sudden she's on probation, she's got to do this and this and this and jump through these hoops, and he can keep her from doing that stuff very easily. So when they say we can't do it because of the law, then sit down and think, is that true? And if so, how do we change this law? That's a very long answer to a very short question. Anyone else with a long question, and I'll give a really short answer?
The next question comes from Lenore in Wisconsin. Lenore, your line is now open.
Hi, Lenore. I'm listening. That's what Fraser says.
Lenore, are you there?
Oh, Lenore, did you mute yourself?
Yes. I just wanted to ask, we're having a lot of trouble hearing and wondered if you could be cautious about staying near the microphone or whatever you're using. You kind of fade in and out for us.
Oh, okay. Maureen, if you can come in here, I'll use the handheld.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's horrible to listen in to something that you can't hear well.
It does make us really pay attention.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'd like to pay attention happily. I'll fix that. I'll move to a handheld situation here when Maren comes in. Any other questions?
Yes.
Just a little technical assistance. You can push the *4, and that should increase your volume on your end, too.
Oh.
That might help.
Okay, I will do that. Thank you.
And, Lenore, we have increased her volume as much as it'll go on our end. So we are aware that it's a little bit difficult to hear, and we've been trying to increase it as much as possible.
Much appreciated. We're certainly enjoying listening otherwise.
Okay,
thanks.
And I've just increased my volume a little. So, Lenore, is that a little bit better right now, what I'm doing? Okay. Any other questions?
The next question comes from Trudy in Nebraska. Trudy, your line is now open.
Hi. I wanted to know, how do you suggest that we get the police to continue to respond to the pattern instead of brushing off the individual instances? It's been my experience that when they come out once or twice, they're initially attentive to the situation. But when you're trying to note a pattern, you know, more from a civil standpoint than a criminal, unfortunately, that some of them that I've experienced in several different states tend to minimize them coming out and take more time before they respond and come to the call. And what do you propose to do to make sure that that doesn't happen, that it doesn't get minimized?
Well, a couple things. One is I think sitting down with the police and getting from them where their frustrations are coming from. And oftentimes in a rural area, if you have a good relationship with your police department, you can get them to identify who are their 10 or 12 or 13 or 14 or 15 cases that they're most frustrated with. And if you can do something that says every time they go out on that case, you will get a hold of that woman and that you'll get back to them about what's happening, you'll reduce their frustration a bit. I mean, that, if you can actively make them think, We see that you're frustrated with this situation because it's just taking up a lot of your time and there seems to be no movement on it. There seems to be no difference, and they've kind of given up on this woman. You know, they're thinking, oh, she's with him again, she's drinking again, she's this again. It's not a good case, it's a loser case. So remember, they're going in with this idea, I'm here to make sure no one gets hurt. But they also are there to investigate a crime scene. And if they see every time they go that it's a loser case, they lose interest because they're not fulfilling their function the way they see it. So if you can establish, and many communities do this, they'll get a list of their 25 chronics or 15 chronics and then establish some kind of a program where there's somebody else coming in to help in this situation. And really thinking it through as a community, you're going out over and over on this case, but also you might be able to notice that the violence is getting worse. She's getting more worn down. She's maybe turning more to drinking. She might be less able to protect herself than she was 3 or 4 years ago. It's looking at it that way, drawing them into that conversation. What's going on with her? Does she look like she's worse off than she was 3 years ago? What's compromising her ability to help protect herself, et cetera? Once you can start engaging in that kind of a conversation, but you have to remember that they want someone else to come in and do something because they don't think what they're doing is working. Now, I don't want to act like police are always the most rational people in the world and they only have the best of intentions for all of us. Sometimes they just get sick of women's weakness, what they see as women's weakness, and some of that personal attitude is in a small police force can kind of grow a little bit, and you get 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 people that think that way, and that can be a huge percentage of the calls that you're dealing with. So sometimes it is individual, but mostly it's a systemic problem on their side, and the solution to it is for you to try to figure out how to address their frustrations. But in the meantime, you're doing a quid pro quo, and you're asking them to document certain things on these calls. One of the things that you want to document early on in these calls is what the victim says is the history of violence. There's 3 basic questions you can try to get your police force to ask every time they go on a domestic. And one of them is, do you think he will seriously injure you or your children? What makes you think yes or no? I know that sounds like 3 questions. That's one. You know, and so you're trying to figure out how dangerous does she think it is. In some cases, in a lot of cases, because of the immediacy of the situation, women will answer that question to that police officer, and they won't do it again to anyone else. They will be open that night to answering that question. Yes, I think he's going to kill me. He's going to kill the kids. He's a nutcase. This is what he's doing. He's just home from the war. He's depressed. He's suicidal. She starts saying all these things that makes what seemed to be a minor misdemeanor really maybe a very elevated case. And so that first question, do you think that he will seriously injure you or your children? What makes you think so or not? Secondly is, what's the time you are most afraid of him or most harmed by him? And the third question is, can you just briefly describe to me the pattern of this? How often is this violence or these acts of intimidation going on? How frequent and how severe are they? So those 3 questions. And you will get if they can engage the woman in trying to figure out that, so they're writing for you, and that's the kind of relationship the advocacy program and the prosecutors and others have to have with the police, saying, if you can get this nice paragraph written for us, then we will respond based on that. In other words, some misdemeanors are just that. They're small incidences of someone throwing something at somebody and hitting them, and it's not a big deal. Other ones are really, really a big deal. And so we need that context in order to know how to follow up. Police have to see themselves as the eyes, ears, nose, they smell, hear, see. They see the fear. They see the lack of fear. They see more than anyone else when they go on that call. And they write down something, and everybody acts based on what they wrote down. So they need to understand that if they can get that, not just that event, but if they can get those 3 questions answered well, and ask it every time they go out to see, and then the readers can see how this is shifting, then we've got much more to base our interventions on than we do when they just are looking at that event that night. But, you know, I always say that when I did intervention work and worked in trying to develop a CCR, half of my job was reducing the frustrations of people in the system with these cases, listening really carefully to what they were frustrated at, why they were irritated, why they were sick of battered women, and trying to figure out ways of reducing that frustration so that they could engage with these cases much more enthusiastically and helpfully. Any other questions before we move on?
No, there are no further questions in the queue.
Okay, great. So, you know, I just went around that, the tactics of the wheel, and I don't really have time to kind of go into each one, but I think when you read those tactics, you know what they are, the use of intimidation, the emotional abuse, and things like that. And I want to say something. If you look at those tactics and think about slavery, the system of slavery that white people set up in this country in its early years, every single one of those tactics, the physical violence, the sexual violence, the isolation, the emotional abuse, the using of children, the using of white privilege, not male privilege, the economic exploitation, the coercion threats, the minimizing, denying, and blaming. I mean, we literally, I'm a white person, and we literally, as white people, wrote that slavery was the white man's burden. Taking care of these African people was the white man's burden. So we turned what we were doing back on the people that we were doing it to. So if you look at that power and control wheel, that's not something that some individual guy just thought up. I think I'm going to use this and this and this. These are the tactics of domination of any group against another group. They're the tactics of race domination, gender domination. They're the tactics that's used in anti-Semitism. It's used against gays and transgendered people. It's used against any group of people. It's used against people with disabilities. These tactics of domination and of exclusion are built into all societies. This isn't something that simply Europeans thought about and spread all over. These tactics of domination are very, very let me just say they're worldwide. Now, there are many societies that were built on much less hierarchical kinds of terms, and those societies have been not only colonized, but in many ways all of the kind of cultural practices that they had that went against this notion of hierarchical relationships have been undermined. But basically, if you go around the world today, this is not something that's just located in the U.S. It's all over the place. When you see it in another country, like a lot of Americans, you know, look at other countries, Asian countries, and they say, oh, women in Asian countries are really, really dominated by their men. Or women in this country are this, or women in this culture are this, or that culture are that. And we oftentimes can see in another culture these practices and these systems of domination, but we don't see it in our own. In our own, we see it as a much more individualized, more psychologized thing, is that this man does this to this woman. So I want to say that the theory that explains that's behind the power and control wheel is what we call the theory of dominance. And it basically is based on the idea that anytime one group of people dominates another, it does so. The wheel is depicted as a wheel because the women who came up with these tactics said that the physical and sexual violence surrounds all these other tactics, and it binds the strength together of his control and his power. And so that's why the wheel was done as the container of those tactics. I wish that we had initially put it into a triangle, because the triangle explains more what it produces, which is a hierarchical relationship. So I want to give you four things that any group of people that dominates another and is successful at holding one group down, they always use four kind of pillars to that domination in all societies. Now, anytime you say all or anytime, it's a stupid thing to say. I'm saying it and I'm thinking, what a stupid thing to say. But I should say a whole bunch of times this is the case. And that is that relationships have to assume that the people at the top are superior to the people at the bottom. And so your institutions, whether it's the law, or your religions, your educational system, has to be built on the notion of superiority of one group of people against another. So whether it's white people or whether it's men over women,
you can see that the history of our of this country and the history of European countries has been that men should dominate women because they're superior to women. Not just because they have more power than women, but because they're literally superior. And so that's one basis. The more you move away from that, and that takes many hundreds of years to move away from that kind of a cultural ideology. And we are moving away from it. The differences between women's status and notions of equality of women today in the year 2008 and when I was born in 1948 is huge differences. And when my mother was born in 1921, there's huge differences. And her mother, who was born in whatever she was born in, over these three generations, this notion of women's equality and men's superiority to women has been squashed a lot. Women are thought of as much more equal to men. We're not there yet, but we're moving in that direction. And so the more you have a system that says that men are superior to women, and the more institutional support there is for that, the more you're going to see violence against women. The second thing is that when you have a society in another pillar of violence by one group against another group is the ability and the society's objectification of the group that's being held under. So if we look again at slavery, it wasn't an individual slave master that said who black people were or who slaves were in this country. It was the whole society talking about who these people were, what their values were, and the need to Christianize them, to give them values, to westernize them, to do all of these kind of things. And so when you saw the rationalization, the entire social rationalization for slavery that accompanied what an individual slave master did in his relationship, that's the exact same thing that goes on in this whole issue of battering. You have an individual man who's hitting the woman, yes, but he's doing it in a context where women are being objectified all the time, and that he's coming up in a society that tells him that women are to be made objects through pornography, through just a million different ways that women are used in advertisements, that women are seen as really different than and objects of. And so oftentimes you'll have a huge difference the way that the legal system, for example, will deal with an assault of a woman who's being prostituted compared to a middle-class woman who isn't mired in some kind of poverty or isn't using any kind of drugs, all those kind of things. So you have this notion of here's a good victim and here's an unworthy or not so good a victim. And so this constant objectification of women on many, many different levels is part of one of the pillars that holds up the notion of battering. When I did men's groups, the men were not coming up with anything original about women. You know, women were stupid. They were sexually out to get them. They were loose. They were immoral. They were this. They were that. All the kind of things that the guys were saying in group. I remember I had worked on this curriculum, and a lot of people were using this curriculum that I had worked on in Duluth with some other people. And so I ended up going to different groups around the country, and then I went to Australia and New Zealand, and the men were saying the exact same things in these groups. And I thought, is this some kind of brochure that's gone out internationally so that you kind of say the same words? So this notion of objectification is not, women come pre-objectified into relationships with individual men, and men are taught and supported culturally, in their communities, and in many, many ways, to objectify women. And the third pillar is this notion of submission of women, that you have to train women, and you have to set up a social system where women are expected to and trained to and encouraged to submit to the superiority of men and to the power over them and to their role of being subservient. And this notion of submission by women also is something that you actually have to get women to teach their daughters. And the notion of superiority is something you have to actually get women to teach their sons. Because one of the main socializers of men and women are women. And so it's not just that we are taught to submit, but we are taught to reproduce this notion of submission in our children and with our children. And there's huge stories we can talk about all this, but the last pillar I want to say is that, and this is the one that everyone on this phone is doing something about actively right now, and that is that when you have a society in which people are free to use violence against another group of people without consequence, that violence will be much more widespread. And so we have successfully, in this country, reduced the number of women being killed, the number of men being killed, the number of people being seriously injured, the length of time that women stay in violent relationships. We've brought battering down significantly over the last 30 years by changing that fourth pillar, the ability to use violence without consequence. And so anyone who says we've spent too much time on the legal system or this, I don't agree with that we've been over-reliant on it. I think we've done half of a job there, and we need to do the other half. I think we haven't done the other things that we needed to do, which those other three pillars are really related to. So it's not going to help us to only do the fourth pillar. But the fourth pillar has made a huge difference in the amount of violence against women that we have. And so I want people to keep those four pillars in mind, because when you have those in mind and when you see things the way that I'm talking about in terms of equating it to what went on in slavery, equating it to relationships of domination, a bigger society, it gives you two things. It gives you more of a sense of history, which means that we don't have to fix everything today. We have to keep thinking of ourselves as changing history, changing culture, changing how it is that power relationships work in our society. And secondly, I think it puts less emphasis on individual men are the problem. They're not. Most of the men that I worked with in my group, yes, some of them I was mad at, and I would get mad at some of the viciousness that they had against women, but I could see that they walked through life in a world and in a society that taught them certain things. And when they sat in that group and they said the things that they said, they really believed them. And they believed them because that's what they were told from the time they were 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years old. So it's not that I don't want to hold individual men responsible for what they've done, but when you can step back and look at the bigger picture, you tend to be less judgmental of both the men and the women that you're working with. And one of the things I'm going to talk about tomorrow is that one of the biggest things that make you successful in working with people around personal change is your ability to connect with them in a way that is not judgmental. Most research shows that whether you're a therapist or a social worker, any kind of a person in the helping field, and a person comes to you for help, they will let you help them, they will engage with you in a helping way if they feel that they're not being judged. And it's the judgment that puts the wall up between you and them. And that wall is what makes many of us wanting to do good actually fail. And we'll talk about that a little bit more tomorrow. So I want to end this section with saying that it's important for us to recognize that battering and being abusive are not the same things. Battering is a system of behaviors and tactics used to dominate. The person who's being dominated is going to resist with violence. The local communities need to deal with the battering one way, the resistance the other, and then know when they've got something other than battering. The biggest mistake they're going to make is to think that the situation is not battering, because I want to go into now some of the dynamics of some of the things about working with batterers. I want to get specific about working with batterers. And one is that batterers almost always portray themselves and actually experience themselves as victims of the people they batter. Okay, I'm going to say that one more time. Batterers portray themselves and oftentimes experience themselves as the victims of the people that they're battering. And this is not that they're always lying to you. They literally do experience themselves as being victims. Again, I want to just go back to bigger picture stuff. I used to, in my batterers group, I used to always play this tape of these three South Africaner white guys who were talking about, oh, my God, you can't have one vote, one man in this country. My grandfathers came to this country. They built this country. This was nothing when we came here. And going on and on and on about how you can't give black people the vote. And then the more they talked, the more they portrayed themselves as victims of people who were living in absolute poverty, working these diamond mines and working for almost no wages, and a lot of white people with a lot of wealth in this country that their grandfathers came to. And they portrayed themselves as the victims of black South African people. So I used to show that in my men's group, and they go, what's the point? I'd say, well, guys, that's what you're doing, you know. You come in here all the time, and you're talking about how you're the victim of this woman. Oh, Ellen, that's too big of a leap, you know. But eventually, I would show enough kind of things where people were portraying themselves as the victims of somebody, including people at in work situations and stuff, and they could see that their bosses, that a lot of people in the factories that they worked at and stuff were also acting like the workers were being too greedy and wanting this kind of a pay raise, and then the head of the company they worked for, you know, made 50 times what they did. And so they could start to see these hierarchical relationships and how they worked. But mostly people were quite resistant to this idea that they are portraying themselves as victims of the person that they victimize. But if you listen to a guy coming into a batterer's program, a guy coming into a visitation center, a guy coming into order for protection court, the things that he's saying are not simply lies. He's not simply lying. He actually oftentimes does experience himself as the victim of the woman he's abusing. The other thing I want to say is that the tactics that an abuser uses are shaped by his culture. They're shaped by his social position. I just watched an interview with a guy who's very, very middle class, and he was being interviewed coming into a visitation center. And he was, oh, my God, I couldn't believe the tactics he was using against this young woman who's interviewing him, who was intimidated by him. He was very middle class. He kept talking about his lawyer. He kept saying, why is it that you need that piece of information from me, and what gives you the right to ask it? He just positioned himself in a position of authority over her in this interview. And it was something that it was just so typical of kind of a middle-class person doing it. Another person coming in might be mad about the same things that she's asking them, but they wouldn't keep referring to their attorney. They wouldn't kind of just assume a position of authority over this person. They might be more intimidate also, but in different ways. I don't have to listen to this stuff. I don't have to sit here and listen to your stuff. Whatever. But the what you'll find is batterers batter within the class rules that they come from, within the cultural rules that they come from. A native guy that's living at the Fond du Lac Reservation is going to use the same tactics around that wheel, but they're going to come out and look quite different. When he uses privilege, he's going to talk about her. He might, for example, talk about traditions, but twist those traditions in a way that would say that a traditional woman wouldn't do this or wouldn't do that. Over here, this working class guy is going to talk about her being a Christian woman, or this guy's going to talk about her being a Muslim woman. They're going to say different things, but they're going to all use her spiritual beliefs as a way of saying, you shouldn't be doing this to your husband, etc. So there's going to be the same thing, and yet it's going to look different. And so one of the problems that we have when we're understanding batterers and we're understanding victims, if we don't understand the cultural ways that people are doing things, we oftentimes don't understand exactly how the battering is occurring. But battering occurs through family, through economics, through children, through physical and sexual attacks, but it also occurs through how it is that she is in her community and then how it is that he interferes with that relationship with community. So remembering that tactics are always shaped by the culture, the history, the class that the person comes from. The other thing is that the vulnerability that victims have of continued abuse will always make it so that they're not free to speak. there's very few places that a woman is free to speak. And I remember one time a woman in my women's group saying, I can't remember, we were talking about something, and this woman said, "Oh, my God." And I said, "What's up, Martha?" And she said, "I'm telling you right now, if my husband heard what we're sitting around here talking about, he would beat me within an inch of my life. I mean, I can't imagine if he was sitting in the back of this room what the trip home would be like." And then everyone was just kind of quiet. And I said, "Have you heard anything in this room tonight that you have thought wasn't true?" And she said, "No, it's all true. But he would never want me to be talking with other people about this. I've thought these things before. I've never talked about them before." And then I asked all the women in the room, I said, "If your partner was sitting in the back of the room tonight and you had to drive home with him, what would he be saying?" And boy, they went off about, "You think this and you think that." And most of them felt that they would get hit for sitting in that room and engaging in that conversation. And so one of the things that we have to remember is that anytime a person at the top of that triangle is dealing with the people at the bottom of the triangle, they are constantly, constantly controlling their voice, what they can talk about, how they can talk about it, what they can be angry about, what they can't be angry about. And so we have to remember that battering, its function, its intention, is to control the other person. So you have to control what they think and how they feel. So you have to control the information coming in as well as what she says going out. And so all of her contact with us puts her in more danger in many ways. And he perceives her coming to us for help as not only an abandonment of him and a rejection of him, but an attack against him. And that's why the elevation oftentimes of tactics and of violence against her when she seeks help. And the mistake that interveners make is not realizing that their very presence in her life is making the situation worse on one level. And so when people come up to him and say, "You have to get a protection order, we're going to take your kids away, or you should do this or else that, you've got to testify against him," it's like sometimes people are clueless as to what that means in that everyday life. Now, if practitioners could think about the judge that they're afraid of, the judge that could take away their job, the boss that they tiptoe around and don't talk to, people in their lives who have power over them that they're not free to speak about, and realize the dynamics that go on there are very similar to the dynamics that go on with battered women, except the consequences more. It's not just losing her job. It's losing her job, losing her house, losing her children, losing her sexual safety, and losing her physical safety. So it's 10 times the loss that we experience, and everybody on this phone, at some time or another, you've probably sat in a courtroom and thought, "Oh, my God, what is that judge saying?" And you've wanted to say, "Your Honor, that was an absolutely moronic thing to say." But none of us stand up and say that because of the cost to us. And so this lack of freedom to speak is a huge, huge factor in domestic violence. I'm going to do a couple more of – I'm going to just talk a little bit before we close out today, and I'll have one more round of questions. But I want to say something about resistive violence, because I think it's as important as the domestic violence of the batterer is the domestic violence of the person resisting that battering. And so most women who are battered in heterosexual relationships use some kind of force back at their batterers, but they use it as part of an overall pattern of trying to cope with or resist the violence. So if you were to have enough time to sit down with a woman and say, "Tell me all the ways that you resisted his total control or dominance, or you resisted the abuse that he was doing against you," you would see that, or you tried to cope with it or change it. One of the biggest ways that women use in the beginning is negotiation. They try to negotiate with them. And then they appeal oftentimes to family or friends or people who can talk for her and that he trusts or he would listen to. They appease him. This is kind of interesting because this is a big thing out right now in because Bush used the appeasement word on when he was in Israel talking, and so that a lot of the political pundits right now are talking about the appeasement word. But appeasement is something that battered women do all the time with their batterers. And oftentimes we get upset with them because they don't appease them very well, you know. But the next one is anger and hostility, is that women exhibit a lot of anger towards him, a lot of hostility towards him, a lot of rejection of him, a lot of, I'm not talking to you. I don't want any more of your stuff. Stay away from me. Oftentimes try to separate, you know, if not physically leave the house, they try to spend as little time alone with him as possible. When they sense that he's escalating in a lot of his anger, his hostility, and she feels that the abuse might start, then she might, you know, say, look, I'm going to go spend some time with my mother, the kids and I are going here, whatever. So separation is another tactic. Withdrawal and separation are both tactics of battered women. And the other one is the use of force. Most battered women will use some kind of force to protect themselves. Now, that force is misinterpreted, and it's both legally and in its social context, that women direct some of the force towards the batterer with preemptive strikes, which sometimes is legal. They use defensive violence during attacks. These lists I'm going to give you right now, the way that women use force, we have a training package that we're putting together that will be ready sometime in the late summer if anybody wants stuff on this. We have videos of each of these kinds of use of force and a training package that you could ask for. You won't get it until September, October, but it's a nice training package. But women use preemptive strikes. They use defensive violence during attacks. They attempt to control future attacks. The violence that they use, like, for example, I worked with a woman once that he came home one day and she took a 38 and stuck it right in his temple as he came through the door. And she said, do you see how easy it would be for me to kill you? And he's standing right there and she said, I swear to God, if you move one inch, I will kill you. And he just stood there, and then she quietly talked to him. She said, never, ever touch me or the kids again. I don't care if they put me in prison for the rest of my life. I don't care what they do with me. I will not tolerate this one more minute. If you ever touch me or if you ever touch the kids, I will kill you. And he never did. Now, this is very rare for this to work, and it's very rare for women to threaten men with weapons like that and then not use them. Usually when the woman pulls out a weapon, she uses it. And so that worked for her as a form of violence. It was, I'm sure, it was totally, totally illegal. But she was attempting to control future violence. Protecting of children and others, that was a protection of children and herself. But there's a lot of violence that women engage in to protect themselves. Retaliation and just the inability to cope. We have a lot of videos of women just talking about how they just went off on him one day. And they just kept hitting him and hitting him and hitting him, and it just was everything exploding in them. And that form of violence by them is an inability to cope anymore with what's going on, and it just comes out in a very, very violent eruption. Women will threaten all of these things above. And sometimes women will seek outsiders to harm him, brothers, relatives, even hiring people to hurt him or harm him. These are all forms of violence that women use against their abuser. And then they also use violence against themselves in the form of drinking and drugs and severe kind of dipping into a lot of depression and drugs and alcohol that go with that, suicide attempts, self-inflicted injuries, cutting, spitting in his face and going up and saying, I don't care what you do to me. And he's hitting her and she's spitting back at him, and he hits her and she's spitting back at him. And she just doesn't. It's what I always call go ahead and do it kind of Pat Benatar's hit me with your best shot kind of violence against herself, saying, I will take anything you give me. I am standing up to you. And so she stands up to him as he beats her and makes visible to him and to her what's really going on. And that happens in a lot of times with women where they've just had it and they show him in her sense, in her mind, what he is and who he is. And so those are the forms of violence that women are using, and that all comes under resistive and coping violence, and it's not pretty, and it's not accompanied with nice words, and it's hostile, and it's angry, and it's filled with all sorts of stuff.
But it's not violence that's intended to dominate, control, and do the same thing that the violence being used against her is doing. That's the significant difference. And we want to stop her violence for her sake, for her kid's sake, and for his sake. But we won't want to stop her violence in a way that gives the batterer more power. That's the trick in public policy. So I'm going to stop right here and open up one more time for questions, and then tomorrow we'll finish up with a little bit more about the different types of violence and a little bit more about victim and batterer's dynamics, and then I want to go into things about the children, and then very practical kind of ways that this plays out then in interventions. So any questions that people want to ask or things that you want to say that you want to be sure that I address tomorrow?
Okay, let me remind you to ask a question. All you have to do is press the number 1 once on your Touchstone phone, and all those questions will be answered in the order that they are received.
So, Ellen, while people are thinking of a question, I have a quick question for you.
So
when we're sitting out there as advocates or probation officers or supervised visitation centers or the courts, when we listen to men who've battered talk about their use of violence, what do we need to listen for? What would be some?
Well, depending on what your function and role is, but I always listen for, you know, my work with batterers is always to try to get to change, help them change what they're doing. But the other one is to figure out what makes them dangerous right now to her in order to protect her right now. And so there's kind of this dual function that I was always in with men, which is let me understand what's going on with you and how you put your world together. That line of questioning, and in doing so, looking for how hostile he is to her, how much he feels that she's ruined his life, what he's willing to do around the children, you know, listening for the ways that he's either blaming her or putting things on her, and then trying to figure out what that all means in terms of what he is willing and capable to do right now without just directly saying how dangerous do you think you are to her. I'm not going to say I had the 10 danger points, but I knew certain things. Like if he was pretty compulsive about his children and where they were and where they went to school and what they were doing, that was always an indicator to me. And then I saw some research that Jackie Campbell did that said that men who are very obsessed about their children are far more likely to harm their children than men who show very little interest in them. Now, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because you think a guy is going to kill kids that he didn't care about. But in fact, I shouldn't say this completely, and I'll correct myself tomorrow if I'm wrong, but I think what Jackie Campbell is saying is that guy who's always talking about the kids and going for more custody and going for this and going for that, and I don't want to say all batterers who go for custody are more likely to hurt them, but guys that are obsessed with their kids are more likely to do damage to her relationship with the kids and to the kids. So there's these things that you look for, and, you know, the biggest thing for me always was not only just how victimized he felt by her, but the ways in which he's talking about her. Like I'm really looking for his the kind of the central point of his fury or his anger or his sense of revenge, as opposed to if there's any self-reflection there or, you know, I really don't need to live with this or whatever kind of attitude. That's a very bad answer to that, but I will kind of do a little bit better on that tomorrow, Beth, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Anyone else have a question?
No, there are no people in the queue right now.
Okay. Does that mean that you all fell asleep, or?
I didn't fall asleep.
Okay, well, good. Okay, so I'll tell you, if you could, Beth, can you give your email address, and if people have stuff you want us to address tomorrow, could you slip Beth a quick email after this?
Yep, so do visitationta@praxisinternational.org. That's
okay.
visitationta@praxisinternational.org, and we'll
okay.
get your question
and
answered.
Liz, can you give yours?
Sure. Email questions can come
yes.
to Liz, L-I-Z, at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, international.org.
So either one of those emails will go to either Beth or Liz, and then
I'll get them, and then we'll talk about those tomorrow morning and build those into the presentation tomorrow. Thank you all for joining us. I hope you come tomorrow. Also, if you, I was a little harsh on the male gender today, so if any of you guys want 30-second rebuttal time, put an email in, and I'll give it to you tomorrow. But I want to thank everyone for being on the line, and remember that someone or something out there loves you.
And don't forget to return your evaluations.
Oh, return your evaluations. If you do it today, then we'll take it on board and kind of adjust for tomorrow. Thank you very much, everyone. Goodbye.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Ellen. Talk to you all tomorrow.